Good afternoon, Your Honor. James Hopkins, representing LH Respondent Father. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, I think the facts are clear in this case. I'm not going to spend a lot of time reciting facts, but I do also think that each finding of the trial court under the law of Colorado is actually erroneous. And I'm going to take abandonment first. Abandonment is measured by intent. And we have case law in Colorado that says intent is best measured by what someone does rather than what they say. In this case, although Respondent Father is incarcerated, he does as much as could be expected of anybody in his situation to try to pursue future reunification with his child. And I think it's important in this case that the backdrop prior to the petitioner's filing for adoption was that domestic relations judge had determined a plan, a safe plan, and a plan that it found to be in the best interest of the child to reunify father. Now, that was not a guarantee, but it was a plan meant in that court's judgment of what was in the best interest of the child to reunify the father with the child if therapeutically that was found to be recommended. So what's father's focus on? He's trying to get out of DOC. He's trying to follow a plan that's already been set up by the domestic relations court. And he did everything he possibly could. There's evidence in the record that he pursued all his options at DOC, parenting classes, any class he could really take. In fact, his case manager, I'm not sure if it was his case manager or counselor at this point at DOC, spoke out on his behalf and said, this person participates to a high level in everything that he does here as far as the treatment programs and rehabilitation options at DOC. He's highly motivated to be involved in his daughter's life. And although there was already a protective court order in place, he requested 2 times during the statutory period to have at least limited contact with his daughter, which was denied, and I don't think that's a surprise because it wasn't really within the parameters of what the domestic relations judge had found was the safest way to reunify. But he's making attempts, and he's making requests, and he's doing everything he can at DOC. He's trying to get early parole. He's paying child support. These are not the actions of a parent whose intent is not to have a future with their child. Now, we can look at everything father did up to that point, and you may be able to say, at some point, maybe he didn't have intent. But when we look at the time, the statutory period, and the immediately surrounding time frame, the actions of the father lead to one conclusion, and that's the opposite of abandonment. He doesn't want that.
Mr. Hopkins, are you asking us to substitute our judgment for that of the trial court, or are you asking for a remand?
I think that the evidence is clear enough for this court to find, even at a higher standard than the standard that is before the court, that the finding was erroneous and that there simply is not evidence that he intends to abandon his child. I think it's that clear. I think it rises to, and my mind's kind of blanking here on the worst possible standard you could have, but I think under any standard, the evidence is very clear that you just cannot characterize the actions of LH as the actions of a parent who is not pursuing reunification.
Well, given that it's an intent standard, and the intent can be inferred from a number of different circumstances, how are we to make that determination when we aren't the judges of credibility? We didn't hear the witnesses. All we can do is read a cold record.
And Your Honor, I understand that the court would be apprehensive to do that. I think that's the best outcome for my client, is to supplant the trial court's judgment. I also agree that on remand, the trial court could be ordered to reconsider, but I would request some specific instructions about why, in the face of the evidence that was presented to the trial judge, what is the evidence of intent that he meant to abandon? And the argument that we make actually is that the trial court kind of glossed over that a little and didn't make a specific finding that there was intent to abandon. The trial court basically, and I think the parties disagree on this based on the answer brief, but the trial court, in our opinion, made a finding that, well, if you get incarcerated when you know you were running the risk of getting incarcerated, that equals abandonment. But that's not what the law says. The incarceration can certainly be a fact that the court can consider, but our brief talked about that pretty extensively, about the circumstances the family was in, and there's kind of an ironic situation here. I'm certainly not going to stand here and argue to the court that my client did what any good parent would, which is violate a protection order, but his motivation was to be near his child. And most of his criminal record, probably about 90% of it, is based on his attempts to be near his child in violation of a protection order. So it's a complex situation, but especially in those circumstances, it's not only unfair, but it's a little, I don't know if disingenuous is the right word, but to me, faulty logic, if we're going to say, well, he got himself incarcerated, so he must not want to be with his daughter. Especially under that backdrop of facts, incarceration cannot equal abandonment.
Mr. Hopkins, let me ask you this. I hear that you're arguing that the fact-finding was erroneous, and then you're referring to the finding about incarceration, and I don't think that you're challenging that your client was incarcerated, but is your argument geared toward that the court relied on the incarceration improperly, or what is your concern about the finding about incarceration?
Well, specifically with regard to incarceration, the trial court placed way too much weight on the fact that respondent father was incarcerated. And although the adoption case is a completely separate case from the domestic relations case, the domestic relations court is also specially situated to try to determine what made sense for this family under the circumstances and what was in the best interest of the child. And the trial court took a safety plan, knowing that the father was going to be incarcerated for what could be a lengthy period of time, and found that that was in the best interest of the child to have this in place so the father would have a route to follow when he came out to try to reunify with his child. Under those circumstances, I think any time incarceration, when we have a parent who's going to be out, and I think within the next few years, and we have statutory guidance when we're dealing with terminations and DNA trials, it talks about, well, if it's more than 3 years, that's a ground for termination. But with adoption, we're looking at a slightly different situation, looking at a child who's already in a safe home, and we're looking at what's in the best interest of this child who's already safe with regard to a parent who may be in an incarceration situation. So I think the context of the case has to be carefully considered before incarceration is given weight. Certainly has to be. But in this case, under these circumstances, father is going to be out in the near future, one way or the other, whether it's through early parole release or through mandatory release date. And that needs to give less weight to the fact that he's incarcerated, because we're not talking about someone who's not going to show up again until this child is, 15, 16, 17. There's going to be a lot of formative years that the father could be present for and participate in, and at a minimum, provide continuing support, which is the next topic that I want to discuss. But did I answer the question?
Yes, I want to follow up with that too. The court had relied on the incarceration. I think that your client was incarcerated in 2006, 2007, around that point in time. So was it proper for the court to be relying on actions that occurred that much longer before the adoption petition had been filed?
Well, Your Honor, I think my answer to this can cut both ways, but I think it's really based on the case. I think in every adoption case, especially when it's contested, the court needs to look at not just the statutory period, but the context that the family's in, and that determining the intent of a parent might become a lot more clear if you look at the surrounding 5 years, say, or 3 years even, and you see that, well, this parent doesn't show a history of trying to be involved or trying to support the child. So that calls into question actions maybe during the statutory period. And it won't surprise me if the other parties make that argument. Well, LH is just doing this because he's now facing a contested adoption. And I think it's natural for parents, when there's a motivator all of a sudden, for them to start to take extra steps. But I think it really is based on the facts of any specific case. What has happened in the past, whatever that may have been, that may change how relevant it is and how far away it was. So my answer is yes, and then maybe sometimes it's not that relevant, depending on how far off it is and how much it impacts the current situation. So I don't know if that's much of an answer, but I really do think it depends on the case.
And you're referring to the statutory period, and that period?
It's 1 year from prior to the filing of the petition that I'm talking about, statutory period. And I think time before that can be very informative for a judge, and I've often argued to trial judges that they need to consider the time outside the statutory period, especially when a parent becomes incarcerated, which is not what happened in this case. And then, sometimes the statutory period is sometimes manipulated because people see a chance from incarceration. Well, there's not going to be parenting time. They may not be able to pay support, so I'm filing right now. And I don't think that's happening in this case at all, but I do think that you have to look at the context of the case as a whole to decide how far back you want to consider the history of the family and the contact of parent and child.
Mr. Hopkins, I'd like you and also your co-counsel when he gets up to address whether we have to remand in light of the Supreme Court case DPH.
And, Your Honor, I think it would be a little disingenuous if I argued you have to remand. I think this court should, at a minimum, remand. And of course, I'm arguing that, at least on abandonment, I think this court can rule with the facts before it. Because I think the facts from the trial record and the court file are clear. The appellate record we have are clear. I don't think it's required. I want to make a couple statements about support.
Mr. Hopkins, just to let you know, you're at 3 minutes.
Thank you. Support's going to be really quick. I think the facts in the case show a history of support, even though it's minimal because my client was in DOC, continued attempts to provide support. And the finding of the trial court was that there's no reason to think support will continue. That just simply defies logic. Is what our argument was in the brief, and that's what our argument is today. The contrary is what I think the evidence supports, is that if father's given the opportunity and is still a parent, that even if not having contact and provide support, he says he will continue to do it, and he has done it in the past. Lastly, regarding best interest, two-thirds of the argument I've already made when it comes to support, when it comes to abandonment, we don't believe the child is available for adoption at all. But if this court finds the child is available, there's evidence from both sides of the aisle at the trial that adoption is not in the child's best interest. It's clear that the petitioners testified they think there needs to be a relationship, and they wouldn't stop one if the child wanted it. At the same time, they say their intention is not to allow one. So there's kind of some conflicting testimony at the trial. The concern is, why rob a child of a biological parent and the extended family if you have a safety plan in place? And that's what we have with the domestic relations order that already exists. That will keep father from having contact if it's not safe. And it's clear if the child is going to suffer from losing contact with the paternal side of the family, at least based on some of the evidence of trial.
But Mr. Hopkins, aren't those just factual disputes that are for the trial court?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that this was really an issue that, I don't know if the trial court made a ruling on whether or not he found the testimony at trial to be in conflict. I think there was testimony that they think the relationship is important. Everybody agreed on that. There was also testimony that they would interfere with it in a legal way. If they had control over parenting time, they would not allow it, and they didn't want the child to have contact with the paternal side of the family. Based on the history of the case, and the record before the court, we didn't feel that that was in the best interest of the child. Unless there are further questions, I'm going to reserve my final word.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Afternoon. Please, the court. My name is David Velasquez, 13778. I'm going to address abandonment. since that's mostly what was addressed in the first instance. In an incarceration case like this, when someone's incarcerated for the entire statutory period, the 12-month period, the analysis is a little bit different, I think. The analysis is only different because of the facts, it's not a different analysis. The fact is that this child was abandoned. And from a child standpoint, this child was abandoned. And the analysis then becomes, was there an excuse? And is it okay, therefore not terminate his rights? And of course, it's the petitioner's burden. It's the same issue in child support. From the standpoint of a child, the child support is unreasonable. It's not reasonable. Keeping in the context of the child's needs, and just from the child's standpoint, it's just not reasonable. So the question is there an excuse for not paying reasonable child support?
Mr. Molesky, is it you look at it from the child's standpoint or from the parent's standpoint?
Both. And I think that the totality of the circumstances, I really don't think there's any argument that this child was abandoned and that the child support is not reasonable.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because as I understand it, a father has made an effort to get 20% of his DOC earnings to the child?
That's true. Now, from the standpoint, from the perspective of the father, or from the perspective of how much money he makes, it may be reasonable. That needs to be balanced with the needs of the child. Also needs to be balanced with the totality of the circumstances. I'm not saying that's determinative. I'm just saying that's the first step. In this case, the totality of the circumstances is evidence of actions before, during, and after the 12-month period. It needs to be considered. All of those need to be considered. It's a relevance question. If it's relevant to his intent during that 12 months, then it should be considered and given the way it deserves, and a trial judge does that.
Mr. Molesky, let me ask you about the DPH case. Doesn't that case say that you look at the 12-month period and not other periods of time?
I don't think so. I think the DPH case says that that court did not look at the totality of the circumstances. And I think that that case and other cases say we're restricted to the 12-month period of time, but I don't think it says we're restricted to looking at relevant evidence with regard to whether or not it's relevant as to the answering the question of was there intent during that 12-month period of time. So,
I guess following up with that, which comes first? Do you first look at the 12-month period and then you look beyond it, or what is it?
The focus is on the 12-month period, and the question is, do you have intent to abandon during that 12-month period? Then you take a look at everything, and I think that evidence before and after may be just as compelling as evidence during the 12-month period, depending on the facts of the case. And I think the trial court has to look at evidence that's outside that period if it's relevant to that question.
Okay, so just to follow up with that too, so that you look at the intent to abandon during that 12-month period.
You look for evidence that supports or goes against the conclusion that he had intent to abandon. Yes.
Okay, so beyond the mere fact of incarceration, did the court look at any evidence of intent during that 12-month period beyond just the fact of incarceration?
Yes. The court did look at there's a lot of evidence, and it mentioned some facts that are relevant here and didn't specifically mention some others. I think that the part of the analysis was consistent with when the petition RHN, in a footnote, it's not precedent, obviously, but a footnote, what the district court said in that case, and quoting the footnote, said, this court cannot ignore the fact that the father had previously been convicted of conspiracy to commit aggravated robbery and required to serve a sentence for that crime. By definition, aggravated robbery is at least a voluntary act. Perhaps the first time resulting in incarceration was excusable, and the failure to support at that time was with cause. At some point, however, the law surely must say that these children should not be deprived because of the voluntary criminal acts of their father. And the court talked about, in some detail, about finding the fact of over between 12 and 15 actions that were charged within a 9-month period of time that caused him to take a step further away from the child, and that ultimately provided to him a 10-year prison sentence. And the court found that those were voluntary acts, that he knew if he did something in violation of the court order or protection order that he was going to get 10 years in prison, and he did it. Goes beyond that. You know, what does it say about the second or third or fourth time when he did it? He knew he was going to get jail time. That's a step further from being a parent. When he does something the seventh, eighth, or ninth time, what does that say about him as a parent? He's taking a step further from the child. And in the 14th time, when it results in a 10-year sentence, he's basically put his foot into the jail cell for 10 years, knowing he has a child out there. Now, that combined with the fact that he blatantly violated the order in the guardianship case after the 12-month period of time is consistent with his actions throughout that whole period of time, and is consistent with a person during that entire time, including statutory time, who is not acting as a parent and not acting like someone who wants to become a parent. Another piece of evidence that was entered that the court didn't specifically state, we presume it considered, was the fact that before the 12-month period of time, during the 12-month period of time, and after, from his testimony, his parole plan was to parole out, go to Texas for 3 years, and then move to Montana. That, together with his violation of these orders that has the obvious effect of harming the child, not even considering that the actual acts themselves had been harmful to the child, to say otherwise, I think, is not appropriate. But those facts, together with his parole plan, leads one to believe that during that 12-month period of time, he did not have the intent to be a parent to this child. All of his actions were consistent with getting further and further away. His parole plan, his violation of the guardian order, just blatant violations, blatant violations of restraining orders. So I think the court considered the totality of the circumstances, considered everything, and made a finding that, in fact, he abandoned the child. And the evidence does not say that he did everything he could to become a parent. He has a parole plan that is opposite of that. And so I think the evidence clearly supports the finding on abandonment. Now, and specifically made findings that the father was in full control to comply with his sentencing and conditions of the sentences, and his actions were voluntary. And the court made specific findings with regard to those types of things. That's on page 11 of 12 of the order, report file page 104. So there's a consistent pattern of actions that are consistent with him not wanting to be a parent. And I think that's what the court found, and that's what the court ultimately decided. I would point out also, Your Honor, to answer the question. In JDK and also DPH, they did consider, I think, evidence that was longer than the 12 months. And if the court considered evidence of abandonment before the 1 year as relevant in the JD case, I think. But the Court of Appeals cases and Supreme Court cases talked about that other evidence that was outside of the period as it relates to the intent of that parent within the 12-month period of time. The child support is basically the same analysis that the court went through. And the first step is that this is not reasonable support. From the standpoint of the child, it's might as well be zero. From the standpoint of the father, it's a percentage of his income, and it's reasonable just within that vacuum. But the same analysis applies. The father put himself in a position where he could not act as a parent, either to support the parent or to actually be a parent, a nurturing a parent. All of his actions are consistent with him not doing that. And I'm cognizant of the language and people in the interest of SST, where the Court of Appeals stated as public policy, as been stated before, a parent seeking to prevent the adoption may not stand upon his parental rights without demonstrating a willingness to assume parental obligations. End quote. I think that's what we have here. We have someone who doesn't want to lose their parental rights, but they have demonstrated over and over again, and the evidence has demonstrated this over and over again, all their actions are consistent with being a non-parent, being a non-parent. In the facts of this case, this is not a reunification case. This would be a unification case. The evidence is that he has no relationship, and the child doesn't know, and those are supported by the evidence. With regard to best interest findings, the court made extensive best interest findings. Court file on page 95 and the court file on page 103, which are pages 2 and 10 of the district court order, made specific findings about the child being enrolled in school, that he had a prior relationship with the aunt and uncle, that the aunt and uncle had gotten them into therapy, that they needed therapy, that the child's adjusted to the family with other children, that the aunt and uncle got them into a private school. The child doesn't know the father, never had a parent-child relationship. That the child knows the aunt and uncle as parents. The aunt and uncle puts the child's needs ahead of their own. There's specific evidence about that, of even denying some family members parenting time because the therapist said you need to do this, even though it may strain relations, and they did that. And all of those findings were supported by the evidence, and I think the findings are sufficient with regard to child support and with regard to abandonment, and I'm asking the court to affirm the trial court order. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here, I just want to clarify quickly regarding Judge Dunn's question about BPH. And I wrote some things in the brief, BPH and JDK together, and I think I'm confusing those a little in my mind. So that is one of the complaints in this case, is that the court did not specifically make a finding that there was intent to abandon. And I think under BPH, that does require a remand. I don't know that it requires anything more than that, but I think that's what DPH calls for, and that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did in DPH. In response to the arguments, there's something a little questionable about saying everything the father's done has been going away from being a parent, because again, he got in trouble trying to make contact, which was ill-advised, but there's a lot of actions that show through litigation and other activities he's consistently trying to keep from losing all contact with his child. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.